For the week of March 24th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 187, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And back in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Back in New York, where were you?
I was in Provincetown, Massachusetts for the annual IRA Awards.
Oh, well, we're going to be talking about the IRA Awards on today's show. But you know, first, can you hear this, Michael? Can you hear the pages turning?
Yes, I can.
Okay, yeah, that's the pages to my copy of Variety from March 19th. It is the last.
Don't tell me you read it. You should have put it in a sealed sack so you could preserve it along with your comic books.
Well, you know, I let's just say I bought out the newsstand because it's now a collector's item. It was the last daily edition of Variety.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you actually buy it?
No, I did not, actually. That's actually a copy of Performances, which is what, I guess, the L.A. version of Playbill for a play called The Nether by a playwright named Jennifer Haley. It is a fantastic play. I guess it premiered here this past week on Sunday night. Great play from a new playwright.
I'll keep an eye out for it.
Yeah, I can't imagine. It's definitely going to go to New York, in my opinion. What I really liked about the last issue of Variety is that it says here, they reported on their own last issue with a headline titled "Variety Ankles Daily Pub Hubbub," which, of course, you know, they have the
classic Variety speak.
Yes, correct. Yes, that's what That was a very long walk for a very short joke.
So that's what they covered in their last issue. What are we covering on today's show?
Well, today, Michael, it's just going to be you and I. I know we've had a couple of lengthy episodes, which, you know, as everybody knows, is Michael's fault. We thought we'd try and throw in a shorter one in here. We're going to try. We'll be talking about the IRA Awards, which you just mentioned, Michael, which, as everybody knows, is the prize handed out by the Irish Republican Army to American entertainment journalists of questionable Irish ancestry.
No. The IRAs are an annual voting group that gets together. They've been getting together since 1976.
Oh.
I joined them in 1993. So this is my 20th anniversary with the IRA Awards. They're a group of film buffs, people who met in film school, and they've all gone on to distinguished careers. Some of them have become Oscar-winning writers and directors. Others have written best-selling, critically acclaimed books about film. Others are educators and reviewers and critics. They're all involved in the industry in one way or another, publicists, all sorts of different people. But they get together every year, and they vote on the awards. Basically, like a lot of people, they watch the New York Film Critics and the LA Film Critics and the Oscars, and they said, we could do a better job than that. So they started getting together in 1976, and it stuck. It became an annual tradition. People travel from all over the country. It's usually a rotating group of people, about 10 to 12 to 15 at the most, perhaps. And we got together in Provincetown, Massachusetts, thanks to the generosity of one of the members. And he put everybody up in a hotel room, and we went and voted on the best films of the 50s, which is sort of an annual tradition as we work our way through Hollywood history. And we voted on the best films of the year.
Of 2012. Now,
that's
so
right.
So then it has nothing to do with gun running?
No, nothing whatsoever.
Impromptu explosives?
Nothing.
Okay, well, and you say, you know, you were put up in a hotel room, but what you really should say is that all of the people in the IRAs were put into one hotel room. There weren't separate rooms, no. You know, so we'll be discussing that in just a moment, but we'll also be following up on a story about Supap Kurtzang, who took on the publishing industry and won a huge victory at the Supreme Court level for advocates of the first sale doctrine. If you don't know what that means, we will explain during Inside Baseball. The Library of Congress added 25 recordings to its preservation list. We'll fill you in on which works made the cut. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. We'll finish up with some listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, we've got information on the weekend box office around the world. The number one movie in the entire world is The Croods, a new animated film by, brace yourself, DreamWorks Animation. It grossed $108 million worldwide. It was number one in North America. It's number one overseas, number one worldwide. It grossed $108 million against a budget of $135 million. So naturally, the people at DreamWorks Animation better brace themselves because heads will roll. It's another successful film. They'll probably start losing their jobs next week.
Well, I'm surprised. You know, Steven Spielberg making animated films, you know, he always said he'd never really get into that after Tintin. He wasn't all that thrilled with the process. And I got the sense that he didn't want to make another animated film.
He wasn't involved.
What, wait, but you said DreamWorks.
Oh, golly. DreamWorks Animation, as I said.
Oh, that's right. And that's this is me being sarcastic, kind of pointing out that DreamWorks and DreamWorks Animation are two separate companies with the same name.
That's the one we got right. It's Time Warner Cable we have to watch out for. But anyway, it's distributed by Fox, but it is a DreamWorks Animation film, a very successful launch to that series. At number two around the world is Oz, the Great and Powerful. James Franco's having a boffo week at the box office, as Daily Variety might have said once upon a time. It grossed $43 million worldwide. It's at $356 million and counting. Still needs to make quite a bit of money to be really profitable, but it didn't have a big drop like one might have feared, but people seem to like the movie. At number three around the world is the action film Olympus Has Fallen. Gerard Butler can have success. It grossed $32 million worldwide, and it's a good launch for a minor B film. At number four around the world is Jack the Giant Slayer. It made another $22 million. It's at $119 million and counting. At number five is Bruce Willis in A Good Day to Die Hard. Another $10 million. It's at $286 million and counting.
And it still has a lot of territories to open up in, I think. At least one or two. No, actually, I take that back.
Well, how many? There's about 50 to 60 territories, basically.
Right. And it was playing in 39 of them over the past weekend, probably because in some territories it's both, you know, come and gone.
Right. So it's hard to track. If you look down the list, you can see that Wreck-It Ralph is playing in 70 territories right now.
That's right.
So there are at least 70 territories worldwide. Unless we could see how many, unless we had a record of how many it has opened in, that's what we really need. It could be 60, it could be 50, I don't know.
That's
so
right.
So what we're lacking is a knowledge about territory by territory openings. It's very hard for us to track. Nobody else really does it for us. So sometimes it's a mystery. We get surprised because a movie opens up in a major territory like Japan or China long after it seemed to be done with. But we'll keep an eye on it. I think Good Day to Die Hard is mostly played out, but I'm not sure. At number six is The Call. That's in North America only. That's the Halle Berry film. That costs another $8.7 million. It's at $32 million and counting. Then there is Identity Thief, which is good news for Melissa McCarthy and
Jason Bateman.
Jason Bateman, who I always think should be in a movie with Paul Rudd so I can confuse them completely. That grossed $7 million. It's at $135 million and counting. And then the real disappointment in North America is Admission, the new comedy starring Tina Fey and Paul Rudd. That opened to a very weak $6.4 million.
I think the reason that it opened so poorly is because everybody went to see Identity Thief thinking that they were going to see Admission, the Paul Rudd movie.
Right below that is Spring Breakers, which answers the question of whether this movie should have opened wide a week earlier. I don't see why. It did just fine. It only cost about $2 million to make. It's grossed $6 million worldwide. It's at $12 million and counting once you add it all up. But this weekend, it made $5 million in North America. Another million overseas. So for a $2 million movie, it's grossed $12 million. It's already in the black. It's Harmony Korine's most successful film to date, I'm sure.
Which isn't saying much, but that's okay.
That's okay. And then below that, a couple other movies, Resident Evil Retribution, Very Ordinary Couple, Wreck-It Ralph, and the incredible Burt Wonderstone, which fell like a rock. It made $4.2 million in North America only. It didn't cost a lot to make, but it's only grossed $17 million. You have to mark it up as a disappointment.
I would tend to agree with you. What isn't a disappointment is Silver Linings Playbook is still playing in 27 territories, made $3.9 million over the weekend.
That's money. And its total, I think, is $220 million, or what is it?
I would say $220 million.
Roughly,
yes.
Right, so a very, you know, still March, still a slow time at the box office, but you're seeing that big movies can open and sustain an audience. Certainly, The Croods had a very strong debut. I think it has a fairly open release schedule as far as family films are concerned. I think it's a while before another big family film comes out. And you might have thought it's competing with Oz, the Great and Powerful, but I think that Oz plays a little older and The Croods plays really hardcore to little kids. So it's a good balance.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. You know, right now the box office is off, at least for this year. And I know, Michael, before you kill me, I know we should wait until the end of the year. It's off 12% tracking from last year. And I know year
or
over year.
Or one hit film.
Right, exactly. Because I look at The Croods, I look at Oz the Great and Powerful. The Croods made $44 million this weekend. The Oz the Great and Powerful in its third week is making $22 million. That's actually not bad. $66 million between two films.
Right. I mean, I don't know what the box office is down compared to last year, but what matters is the movie and its budget. Oz the Great and Powerful cost $215 million to make. It's only grossed how much so far? It's grossed $356 million. So, you know, it needs to make $600 million to talk about breaking even and being really profitable. That's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money. But don't you think that it will do so on DVD and...
We're talking about box office leading into all the profits it'll make down the road. The Croods, of course, almost made back its budget in its first weekend. That's a really big success story.
Right, because it'll probably wind up somewhere around $400 million when all is said and done.
That's right.
But now, okay, so we talked about the movies from this past weekend. And as we said at the head of the show here, we're going to be talking about some movies not only from 2012, but also from the 1950s. That you, Michael, and your team up there in Provincetown, is it Provincetown that you were in?
That's right.
Okay, Provincetown, Massachusetts, and I say your team, but really it's your colleagues there at the IRIS. IRIS stand for? I mean, it's not Irish Republican.
It's named after Ira, one of the members. The story of why it became named after him is lost in the mist of time. So I'm not really quite sure why or how it became named after Ira, but why not? That's what I say. So they've come up with fake names for themselves, like the New York Very Independent Film Critics Circle and other things, but they've just stuck with the IRAs. They're smart people. They definitely lean towards art house cinema, international fare, challenging movies. They're not interested in movies that are easy and populist. You know, some people liked, like, for example, you know, every movie has its adherence. But in the IRAs, you're going to find a lot more international fare, which will explain why the movies that they picked as the best of the year come from all over the globe.
Well, I'm surprised then that if they're picking challenging movies that aren't populist, I'm surprised The Hobbit isn't among some of the best of the year on the best of list for 2012.
Well, it is on my list for Dramamine. We have a category for negative awards. Dramamine is the movie that made you sickest that year. Les Mis was very popular in those categories for Dramamine and Sominex and Mechanical Actor and Actress, which is an award for the least convincing and the most mechanical is, you know, a performance you've seen it before again and again, either by that actor or just in that role is not convincing.
Well, did Russell Crowe win the Fire Your Singing Coach Award?
He, in fact, did win lead actor for best mechanical actor, or worst mechanical actor, I should say. He did win that, but right behind him was Sacha Baron Cohen and then Hugh Jackman and some others. The women filled up the category of mechanical actors. That movie was not liked by the IRAs. But there were some movies that were. The best film of the year, I think it won 5 top awards, including director and screenwriter and best supporting actor, is Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, the Turkish film that I think you saw at Cannes.
Yes, indeed. We saw it together, yes. As a matter of fact.
There you go. Yeah, it's a terrific movie. At number 2 is a tie. They include The Deep Blue Sea, the Terence Davies film from England, a beautiful movie starring Rachel Weisz, who won Best Actress, and The Loneliest Planet, a film that is set in Georgia, the former Soviet Republic, and it stars Gael Garcia Bernal, a very good movie. And the right below that from France.
Say Thelonious Planet? Is that a movie about Thelonious Monk as an entire...
No, the Loneliest Planet.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
It's a sad, lonely little planet. Apparently, okay. The little prince is not there. At number 4 from Belgium is The Kid with a Bike, another film by the Dardenne brothers, one of the great filmmaking teams of the past 15 years.
And a great movie, I might add.
Yes. And at number 5, Django Unchained. So they don't dislike any movies that are popular. There was strong support for Django Unchained, the Quentin Tarantino film. So those are the top 5 movies of the year. We'll have links in our show notes to all the categories if you're interested. Basically, like any list like this, if you see one or two movies that you like, then you can think, well, gee, I like their taste. Check out the other movies, and I'm sure you'll stumble across some challenging, satisfying fare.
Well, here's 3 movies I'd like to ask where they wound up. Zero Dark Thirty.
One person voted for it for Best Actress.
Okay, wow. Silver Linings Playbook.
Robert De Niro was among the 5 people to be a place in Best Supporting Actor. It also got some attention in negative awards.
Okay. I'm going to add another movie in here, Lincoln.
Lincoln, one person was very strongly supportive of Daniel Day-Lewis and the production design. Sally Field placed in Best Supporting Actress. She wasn't the winner, but she was one of the people who made the cut to the top 5.
And finally, Argo, this year's Best Picture winner at the Academy Awards.
It wasn't mentioned even once.
My goodness. Well, then you also have
these are tough guys. You look at Amour, the Michael Haneke film, which is a film very much that would appeal to them. Jean-Louis Trintignant actually won Best Actor from the IRAs. Emmanuel Riva was second place for Best Actress in a very tight race with Rachel Weisz. But they're like, ah, it's already gotten too many awards. You know, other people refuse to vote for it because it has too much attention already. So they're hard to please, those IRAs.
Well, and also you shouldn't be awarding art based on how many other awards it's received. It should stand on its own.
You know, if sometimes a movie is so great, you won't ignore it. But other times, if you're choosing between equally terrific movies, you might shine the spotlight on one that hasn't gotten the attention it deserves. Certainly, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia was not a big player at the Oscars.
No, it wasn't even a big player.
Or on any other awards, frankly, in North America. And it's a great film.
It is a good film. And it wasn't a big player, say, in theaters as well. So, but that said, you know, you talk about not being populist and going for the movies that everybody knows. You also, with your team there at the IRAs, you picked the best movies of the 1950s, and I would say that I've heard of some of these films: Touch of Evil, Vertigo, Rear Window, The Searchers, Anatomy of a Murder, North by Northwest, and Pickpocket, just to name a few.
That's right. The best films of the 50s is a laborious process. We have everybody comes up with their top 100, and then we take the top nominees, and we have runoffs, and we come up with a final ballot, and then everybody ranks that final ballot from their favorite to their least favorite, giving the top one 100 points and the bottom one 1 point. And then we have showdowns between movies that are tied, and that's how we come up with our final list of the best movies of the 1950s. As with any group list, I hate some of the films that are on this list, and I love others and wish they were higher up on the list, but that's what happens. But we had a lot of polling. And again, if you're looking for some movies to see, you've probably seen Rear Window or The Searchers. But if you haven't seen some of them, you know, give them a try. You're sure to find some great movies. Our top pick for the best movie of the 1950s is probably a movie that a lot of people haven't seen, even though it's a very well-known, you know, popular film among critics and cineasts. It's The Earrings of Madame Du. By Ophuls. It's a great romantic drama, very entertaining. It's not a challenging or difficult film like perhaps Once Upon a Time in Anatolia is. It's just a terrific film in French. For heaven's sakes, if you've never seen it, you know, give yourself a treat and check it out.
You know, what makes Once Upon a Time in Anatolia so challenging, besides the fact that it's in Turkish, so anybody who doesn't speak Turkish actually, you know, is reading subtitles, which is not challenging in and of itself, is that...
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, that I'm joking, of course, there. But is that Ceylan, the filmmaker, he is a very slow-moving, long-take filmmaker, very poetic, very beautiful imagery, and it is a very slow film in which very little happens, and yet everything is happening.
They go for a car ride in the movie, and you're in the car with them for about 40 minutes.
Yes, correct. As they're looking for...
Literally. Yes, literally.
Exactly. It almost takes place in real time.
There's no such thing as real time in the movies. But anyway, moving on.
Right. Well, I guess we should move on to music. And we're going to be discussing the 25 new recordings that were added to the official Library of Library of Congress preservation list.
That's right. It's kind of exciting. Every year, the Library of Congress picks out 25 recordings, not just music, but radio broadcasts, news clips, speeches, you name it. And they say, we're going to officially preserve these. These are recordings of note. Everyone should be aware of them. They're part of our national culture and history. And here they are. So it's kind of a fun thing. You can see a lot of popular fare like Saturday Night Fever soundtrack is on there. And perhaps the earliest recording is After You've Gone, a classic tune recorded by Marian Harris and made popular by her. That's all the way back from 1918. And then you go all the way forward to, like I said, Saturday Night Fever. And I think the most recent thing on the list is a great jazz album, The Audience with Betty Carter, which is not only a great jazz album, but it was when she launched her own record label and was sort of a second win for her career. So that's why that album is notable. And it's filled with all sorts of recordings that are fascinating to pay attention to.
Wow. So After You've Gone, Marian Harris's hit, that was from 1918. It feels like just yesterday. But we have a link to the list of all 25 recordings. Michael, what do you think is the most popular addition to the Library of Congress this year?
Well, people campaign and people poll people and people write in notes saying, my God, why isn't this on the list? And if the thing that got the most votes and has finally been added to the list is Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, one of the best-selling albums of all time and a great album and an important album, and it ran on the charts for, you know, 10, 15 years, as we've discussed recently. It's historic on many different levels, and it's certainly, I think, the one recording that everybody will have heard of.
Okay, well then, what edition is on the list this year that you think probably shouldn't have been there?
Well, there's a D-Day radio broadcast by George Hicks, and there's a couple great D-Day broadcasts. I'm not sure which one I would have gone with, but that one I think has survived because they filmed him. And so he's on the deck of a ship, and because they filmed him, you can actually see him doing the broadcast. And I think that's why that has lasted the test of time. And I love that Frank Yankovic, Al Yankovic's father, I love that he's on the list for his polka hit, just because that launched him as America's polka king. And of course, his son is a great satirist. But I think
you mentioned that. I was saving that up to mention
at
the end.
I'm sorry. But, you know, it's not my favorite polka, but I'm glad it was a hit for him. But I think the one thing on here that does not belong is Simon and Garfunkel.
What? Now,
I love Simon and Garfunkel, but what they put on this list is their second album, Sounds of Silence. Now, they have other recordings that are on the Library of Congress list, like Bridge Over Troubled Water, the album. And the song Sounds of Silence deserves to be on the list because it's a signal significant recording. But the album is not good. The album is weak. And, you know, the recording was made with other people. And it's only when they came back and it became an unexpected hit that they did their third album. And then really their fourth album, that's where they really hit greatness. The album itself is a hodgepodge, not very good, not representative of their brilliant work as a team or Paul Simon as a solo artist. So I really don't think that belongs.
So the whole album is there.
Right. The album is there. And if they put the song on, I would say that makes sense. But the album is not good. Their first album is even weaker, Wednesday Morning 3 a.m. That's a bad album. Sounds of Silence is barely, it's okay. But even if you're a fan, you probably never listen to it because it's just not that good.
Well, now, what was, in your opinion, the most influential recording that made the list this year?
The most influential? I would have to say...
Dark Side of the Moon?
That certainly sparked a lot of concept albums. Not that there weren't plenty before that, but that certainly was a major album radio hit that sort of influenced people playing entire sides of albums over the radio because it was such a suite of songs that they, you know, they'd play side A and then they'd play side B late at night. So that sparked a lot of that sort of programming on album radio. But I think the most significant recording is probably the cast album, The South Pacific. That came out in 1949. It was a massive, massive hit. It sold over a million copies. It came out on the new LP format, so it helped to popularize LPs. It also came out on 78s, and it cost like $4.85, but it was so popular that the real thing it did was it sparked bidding wars to get the rights for cast albums from Broadway shows. Broadway shows had always churned out hits and sparked, you know, song recordings that would become hits on the radio, but it was really this that helped popularize the album, the LP, and the idea that Broadway was a great source for hit albums. And so record labels were bidding for Broadway shows after this for quite a few years, the 50s and the 60s. Broadway was a big source of popular recordings. And so that was really important.
I could have sworn you were going to go with Begin the Beguine by Artie Shaw, which was a 1938 recording, or You Are My Sunshine, sung by Jimmy Davis in 1940. I could have sworn you would have gone for either one of those.
Well, I love the Artie Shaw, and Jimmy Davis song is certainly a standard, but I don't know how influential they've been.
What about Saturday Night Fever by the Bee Gees from 1977?
Well, I think disco was already popular. I think that just epitomized disco. It wasn't that it made disco popular so much as it just cemented it and made us hate it so much.
Okay.
But obviously, it's a landmark recording. It's a great soundtrack. It's a little cheesy at times, but the songs that are good on it are absolutely great.
Now, I know you must be very pleased that Einstein on the Beach, the Philip Glass opera, made the list.
I am. I'm thrilled. I love Philip Glass. I've followed his career, you know, since I was a kid. Everywhere I've been, I've either interviewed him for that publication or written about his work. Just seeing the recent revival of it, which was just tremendous, was a thrill at the Brooklyn Academy of Music here in New York. It's just winding down its worldwide tour, this production. It's kind of sad to see it disappear. It's the final production with the original team involved. And so to see that original recording that they made back in the 70s get on the Library of Congress list, it's long overdue and it's great to see.
They're actually bringing it here to Los Angeles next year. Or actually this year, if I'm not... I'd have to double check, but it's on their slate.
Yeah, I think it's... I don't know if it's in LA specifically, but it's sold out already.
Yeah, it's in LA and it's literally three shows. That's it. They're coming for three shows and they're gone.
Well, it's the opera. They don't do 50 shows, so, you know. But yeah, it's sold out all over the world. So frankly, if you don't have a ticket, you really can't catch it too easily. But, you know, it's a great production.
So you'd say it's kind of a big deal.
It was certainly a big deal in my theater going life.
Wow. So I guess that means we should move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about Bill Carter, but not really. Bill Carter was on last week's episode. Of course, he's the television reporter from the New York Times who apparently can tell the future because he said that Jay Leno probably wouldn't make it past 2014 on The Tonight Show, and he was right. The madness at NBC continues. It's now official that NBC is dumping Jay Leno again. His contract is up in 2014, and NBC will place Jimmy Fallon as the host of The Tonight Show, returning the show to New York City, where it began, originally with Steve Allen. Jimmy Kimmel often ranks third at 11:30, but does well enough in the key demos that NBC fears he will establish himself as the young, cool face of late-night TV, and they want Fallon battling him head-to-head. The only decision now is, when should Fallon start? In February of 2014, after the Olympics, or in the fall? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
We've talked about it a lot. It is a big deal. It is official. It seems crazy to me. I'm seeing more and more stories saying, why is NBC dumping the number one guy in late night? It really makes no sense. Jay Leno has no friends anywhere, I don't think. But I keep defending him to a degree as far as a business decision. I just say, it's ridiculous. It makes no sense. And he's probably going, what the heck am I doing wrong? He would do it for another 20 years if he could. And he's, you know, they messed up once and now they're with Conan O'Brien and now they're doing it again. And he must just be shaking his head trying to figure out what is going on with those pinheads. And, you know, Jimmy Fallon versus Jimmy Kimmel, it's like Merv Griffin versus Pat Sajak as far as late night talk show hosts are concerned. So I bet if Leno goes, Letterman will be number one.
Wow. Okay. So that's a prediction that we could follow up on.
Absolutely.
Well, now, speaking of number one and big audiences and TV audiences, the second season of the HBO comedy Girls is over, but the reverberations are still being felt. And here's why. The show is a critical hit. But more fascinating to us is how the young skewing series has upended the idea of watching TV. People simply don't feel the need to watch the show when it first airs. The number of viewers tuning in has plummeted compared even to the modest numbers of season one, despite the show's growing profile. But when you add in the multiple airings in HBO Go and HBO On Demand, you discover the show is a solid hit for the channel. The initial airing of the season finale reached 632,000 viewers, substantially down from the 1 million viewers that tuned in for the season one finale. Disaster! But wait. Add in two more airings on the night of the finale, and total viewers reached 1.1 million viewers. But wait, there's more. 27% of its viewing audience came via HBO Go and HBO On Demand. Let's not forget DVR users. So add up live viewers on multiple airings, DVR watchers, HBO Go, and HBO On Demand. You know, how hard is all that? You wind up with 4.6 million viewers. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a very big deal. I mean, when you look at the initial audience tuning in for season two finale, you say, uh-oh, this show's in trouble. Because historically, it should build. Even if people are watching on HBO Go and on demand and DVR, you expect the viewership to grow if the show is growing and becoming a better hit. And in this case, it didn't happen. I mean, it dropped kind of substantially. People are happy to watch the show, but they have absolutely no compulsion to watch it when it first airs. And that's a radical change. And so it really takes a week or two to find out how many people watch the show and actually how much of a hit it is.
Yeah, I mean, 4.6 million viewers, that's quite a bit.
Yeah, I don't know what she did in the first season, but I think it's up a little bit. And it's just amazing that it takes so long to find out what's going on and what's a hit. And you can't base it on overnights anymore. I think those are becoming more and more misleading. You know, they look, oh, overnights, it dropped 30% from last year. Well, you know, that's just not the way it has to go anymore. You can't pay attention to that.
You know what's better than 4.6 million viewers?
What?
11.5 million viewers, and that's exactly what this past season here in the U.S. on PBS, which is where Downton Abbey is shown, 11.5 million viewers a week it averaged.
Wow.
Yeah, it's apparently a huge record for them.
And I tried to find out what Upstairs Downstairs did in the 70s when it was a much smaller universe and a lot more people watched basic television because you didn't have cable. So I couldn't find any figures. I'd love to know because it won the Emmy. It was a big hit. It was a phenomenon, just like Downton Abbey is. And it was a much bigger pie cut up into fewer slices. Does that make any sense? There was just ABC, CBS, NBC, and PBS. That was basically all you were competing with.
Right.
So I couldn't find out those numbers, but they say it's their highest rated series ever or the highest, you know, viewership. But wow, look at that. It's up like 35%.
No, 65% from season two.
No. 35% from the overnight numbers that we had. We thought 7 to 8 million people were watching this show. That's what we were told all season long. And I thought, God, that seems low. And in fact, it's like 30% bigger, 35% bigger. It's almost 12 million people. That's a big difference from 7 million. Well, so, you know, again, we've been told all season how big the audience is for Downton, and we're off by a massive factor of 30%. That's a huge distinction.
Yeah, and the total audience itself, they say here, is up about 65% from the second season. So that's, yeah, that's what you right. just clarified for us. And apparently, the season finale, the day after it aired, the public broadcaster PBS said that there were 900,000 video streams on the Masterpiece website in one day. And that's the most ever for that site, which doesn't
surprise
me.
And that's not a compliment. It happened because they screwed up on the ending and went over like a minute into the next time slot. So people who DVR'd it, some people in parts of the country got screwed up. I know my mom's in Birmingham, Alabama. She had friends who missed the last minute or so of the show.
Yeah.
And so they were like, ah!
They do that for two reasons. One is the DVRing. So that's number one. And number two, it's the way Nielsen works that that first minute is, you know, is what counts on those boxes. They count that first minute, and since it overlaps into the next hour.
Well, Nielsen can't do that anymore, or they're buffoons. Well, they cannot possibly count, you know, the Cosby Show, number one show in the country, as the rating for the next show that appears. They, by this day and age, they have to be making that distinction. There's no way they're being tricked into thinking the show that follows Downton Abbey is as popular as Downton simply because they go over a minute. It's just idiotic. It's not tricking Nielsen. It's not tricking anyone. It just annoys people who are trying to set their DVRs.
Well, let's talk about ebooks for a second, because Publishers Weekly, you know, that
say that again?
Publishers Weekly?
There you go.
Okay. Wow. I guess you did notice that little verbal stutter there. They listed the best-selling ebooks of 2012, headed by 15 million copies each for the three books in the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy. They said Blacklist sales were not surprisingly...
Backlist.
Well, I can't seem to say anything right today. Well, okay, so backlist sales were not surprisingly weighted heavily towards big-name authors like Nora Roberts. They also noted that the mass market paperback sales were directly affected by the availability of, guess what?
Ebooks.
That's right. They said most books sold more copies in print than ebooks, but that would soon change, especially since Borders is gone and Barnes & Noble is headed towards... being out of business. The phenomenal bestseller Gone Girl sold more than 1 million ebooks and 900,000 print books, but it was the exception, not the rule this year or last year. But wait till next year. That would be this year. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? And did you understand anything I just said?
Not a word.
I didn't think
people
so.
People are selling lots of ebooks. I understood that. And
wait,
I don't think
the they're stealing lots of ebooks?
Is that what I said?
Yeah.
They're selling a lot of ebooks. Which,
I did say that blacklist sales were up.
That's right. So ebooks are very popular. They're still growing a lot. You're even seeing some big bestsellers like Gone Girl sell more in ebooks than print. That is clearly the wave of the future. I don't think publishers have fully embraced and grasped what is happening here because they're not changing their strategy on paperbacks. And to me, when ebooks come out and they're like $12 and they're trying to sell paperbacks for $12 or $13, why are they waiting a year to put something out in paperback? To me, it's just there's no point to the paperback anymore. At least not holding it off for a year. It just doesn't make sense. They want to buy in hardcover, let them buy in a hardcover. They want to buy paperback, let them buy paperback. But making them wait a year, it doesn't work anymore because that cheaper price point, which is what the paperback was, well, that's being introduced day and date with the hardcover. So I'm not quite sure. I think it's going to have a much bigger effect on paperback sales in the next few years, and they have to rethink their strategy as far as release dates and formats for the book. I think everything should come out the same day.
Well, it's funny that you should mention this because, you know, the classic business school example that's always used about product management and about the product life cycle is the book industry because they are very blatant about their versioning and they take advantage of people who are the most devoted customers. So let's take Stephen King, for example, since that's pretty much the author every business school uses when talking about this. Stephen King, you're a big fan. He publishes a new book called Under the Dome. You want to get it right away. So you go out and you buy the hardcover and you pay $20, $25 for that. So you're paying a bit of a premium for being a fan and a big fan. If you want to wait and you can, you know, you're not that big a fan, you wait for the paperback to come out in 6 months to a year and you're paying, you know, $10, $12, whatever the case might be. So effectively, the publisher has been able to take advantage of a higher cost product and then lower the cost in you know, later months and in a later window. That said, you're absolutely right. If they're already lowering the cost of the product because they're selling it as an ebook for $12.99, then there's no reason for the paperback to be delayed.
And here's the counterexample that sort of confuses us in the book industry. The most popular books are the new books by the newest authors, and those are often the cheapest compared to other hardcover books. So when a new book comes out, there's high demand, and they discount it heavily. It may be a list price of $25, but they're selling it for $14 on Amazon and in Barnes & Noble. And then 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years down the road, if you want to buy that book, then you got to pay $25. And you say, well, wait a second. There was high demand and you charged a low price. Now there's low demand and you charge a high price. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, wait a second. Yeah, I mean, I guess technically what they're saying is, you know, it's scarcity. It's supply and demand. The supply is down there and the demand is down. Well, yeah, I'd have to actually figure that out.
Exactly. It's a little counterintuitive.
Yeah.
But there you go. There are changes afoot in the book industry.
Well, I guess 6 years later, if you're still looking for Gone Girl, they must figure, hey, you really want to read this book, and therefore we can charge you for it.
I saw somebody online when I was in Provincetown who said, oh, I'm getting back into reading. Just about done with the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy. I'm like, actually, you're not. But anyway.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we were talking about HBO just a moment ago, and listener Raul Baril, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Raul. Raul Baril, he brought us this story, and he brought it to our attention via Facebook. He actually posted it to our Facebook page, and you can do that. You can post stories that you want us to cover to our Facebook page, and we do monitor that. So thank you, Raul. And the story is about this. HBO is taking another step forward in making its programming available to people who don't subscribe to cable and its premium channel. And I think Roll said hell frozen over. Yeah, something like that. Of course, the dream of many people who don't want cable is to pay for access to HBO Go, the online streaming service that lets people access their entire library, HBO's entire library of original programming, including new episodes of Game of Thrones and Bill Maher, along with the entire run of Sex and the City and The Sopranos and so on. It happens overseas. HBO Go is available via streaming in Norway, for example. Now, they are finally talking to broadband providers about packaging HBO Go with broadband service, adding, say, another $10 or $15 a month to that little pill and providing HBO Go to users in exchange. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a very big deal. What about you?
Well, I think it could be a big deal and yet a big whoop, and here's why. Where do you get your broadband internet access from? Who sells it to you? Who do you pay?
I get it from a company that is not linked to Time Warner, the multimedia conglomerate. It's called Time Warner Cable.
That is correct. So basically, as Richard Plepler said here, he said, and he's the head of HBO, he said, look, we're talking about it. We're going to have to make the math work. And what he means by that is, hey, right now, the reseller of our product are MSOs, cable providers. And we can't screw them over. But since so many people actually purchase their broadband internet service from cable providers, we wouldn't be screwing them over at all if they just tacked $10 on to their broadband bill.
But yeah, but they're opening the door. Before they said, no way, never, not going to happen. You have to have cable in order to get HBO Go. Now they're saying, yep, we're talking about it. And so eventually they're going to maybe have an online website where you just plunk, you know, once you open the door, sure, you start off with that. And then the next thing you know, they're got a website. You just pay them $10 a month and you get it and you don't need a cable provider at all.
Right. And actually, that is precisely what I said on Facebook in response to Raul. I said, you know, how long before HBO is going direct to its customers without worrying about a broadband provider
and making more money.
Right. And MSOs, multi-system operators, as cable providers are often referred to, you know, they might say, hey, you know what? This sounds good in theory because we're still getting the money because we're getting the extra $10 or $15 that we would have gotten from a cable subscriber. But you know what we're not getting? The extra $50 to $60 for them subscribing to the entire cable package so that they could get HBO, which is what we'd really like.
But it's going to happen.
It probably will, yeah. I mean, because really what this will truly do is cut down on piracy.
Why is that?
Because right now Game of Thrones is one of the most pirated shows on television. Girls is quickly becoming one of the most pirated shows.
Isn't that overseas?
Most of it is, yes. Most of it is overseas.
And they won't be able to buy this service overseas?
Well, they can in Norway.
Oh, okay. So you're saying if they expand it worldwide, if people can get access to shows without having to wait for it to be debuted in their... They also have to get day and date debuts. If they're going to open Game of Thrones in North America, they got to have the season begin in other parts of the world as well, especially after it's a hit.
Right, especially now that streaming is available. In fact, if YouTube were a country, this next story is about YouTube and how it's joined the Billionaires Club. Apparently it made $1 billion or something. But if YouTube were a country, as I was just about to say, it would be the fourth most populous country in the world.
Okay.
Okay, and that's really one way YouTube tried to trumpet the news that it attracted more than 1 billion viewers or unique visitors a month, which is slightly more than, Showbiz Sandbox, for instance, slightly more than Showbiz Sandbox, and actually most other websites. They compare that monthly audience to 10 Super Bowls, for example, and say that if those 1 billion unique visitors equaled its population, they would rank behind China, India, and Facebook, and slightly ahead of Showbiz Sandbox. Big deal or big what, Michael?
We're more like Bermuda, an exclusive island resort.
Yes, exclusive being key.
It's a big deal. It's a new club. It's a new metric for massive, massive success online. Can something that's at 1 billion viewers collapse? You know, can Facebook collapse? People keep saying it's so big now and unwieldy. People can't keep track of everything. Now maybe it's such a big lumbering beast that maybe people could, you know, introduce a new service. You think Netscape will never die. You think Facebook can't die. But at some point, do they become too big to fail? I think that's what we might be seeing for Facebook and YouTube. They're so big that, yes, I've got an account on Google Plus, but I ain't giving up Facebook because it's just too convenient to reach people.
You know, that's exactly my friend. He works over at Kodak. He was saying the exact same thing. Way too big to fail. It'll never happen.
At Kodak.
At Kodak, yeah. About Facebook, he was saying. See, it's the joke there.
I got it.
Just checking. Chinese box office revenues grew a massive 34% in 2012, hitting $2.7 billion for the year. That makes it the second biggest market worldwide behind North America, which is way out in front at $10.8 billion. Well, yeah, let's just wait a couple of years. Japan is now at number three with $2.4 billion, and with worldwide box office at a record $34.7 billion. That's what the worldwide box office took in last year. Next, you have the UK, then France, India, Germany, South Korea, Russia, and then Australia. They range from $1.7 billion on down to $1.2 billion, or as I like to say, chump change. Right below Australia is Brazil at $800 million. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. That's why we focus on the worldwide box office. If you look at Brazil, Russia, India, and China, the BRIC countries, B-R-I-C, they estimate, I think in Hollywood Reporter, that in just a few years, their box office will be the equal to North America, as it should be, since they have about, you know, 3 billion people in them. There's no reason why it wouldn't be a lot bigger than the U.S., but they're going to catch up to the U.S. in just a few years because they're, you know, building a lot of theaters, getting modernized. They're going to keep exploding in the box office dollars, and that means more big Hollywood movies with a lot more money to be made.
That's right. The expanding middle class in those countries, you'll have to blame for that, as well as why the price of gas is so high, but that's another story. In any case, producer Dick Wolf offers the only bright spot on NBC's schedule with his new drama Chicago Fire and the long-running Law & Order SVU on Wednesday nights. He's also known as a tough penny pincher who readily dumps actors from hit shows when they think they deserve, say, I don't know, a bagel from Kraft Services or, more than likely, a bigger paycheck. For Wolf, the show is the star, not an actor. It's a little surprising that Wolf hasn't already pitched a U.S. remake of the German cop series, and I'm going to get this wrong, and I hope not, but Tatort? Is that how you pronounce this, Michael?
Your guess is as good as mine.
The Law & Order-style series has been on the air since, 40 years, 1970, but just hit a 20-year high in the ratings with 12.8 million viewers watching a recent episode in Germany. That would put it easily in the top 10 for the U.S., even though Germany is a quarter of our size and population.
So that's like 40 million people watching an episode of a series.
Or, wow. Yeah, the Super Bowl, effectively. But here's the kicker. They often introduce a new investigative team on every single episode. The entire series practically runs on guest stars. A few weeks ago, movie star Till Schweiger of Inglourious Basterds starred on an episode of the series as a lead investigator and enjoyed a huge ratings increase. As well, no stars. Wolf must be salivating right now. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a big deal. It shows TV can still reach a broad audience. It's a kind of a fascinating format. It is kind of appealing. I'm surprised he hasn't jumped on it. Law and Order is sort of like that. And earlier in the show's run, they did have teams that would stay together for a couple seasons. It wasn't always like this. Every week there was a new team. It's sort of a more recent trend. And they still have teams that sometimes last, apparently, for 6 episodes or 8 episodes or however long. But it's kind of a cool format. It lets big name stars like Till Schweiger, or you can imagine the U.S. equivalent, drop in into a TV show, get a big audience for a week, and then drop back out again without having to commit to a long-running TV series. So it's kind of an interesting thing, and it's good to see TV can still reach a big, broad audience.
Amazon has kept pace with the changing nature of e-readers, expanding to the Kindle Fire tablet as regular e-reader sales slow down. But they're not done yet in competing with the Apple and Samsung gang that has stolen their e-reader thunder. They're working with various websites like Time and the Washington Post to flow more content to the Kindle. Maybe that 30-page cover story on healthcare in Time caught your eye, but you weren't quite ready to tackle it, or you were called into the doctor before you got to finish it in his or her waiting room. You could click Send to Kindle, and that article would automatically be ready to read on your Kindle the next time you synced it up. Thus, you can easily add lengthy articles and features for reading to your Kindle whenever you want. Amazon, of course, wants to expand this feature to many more sites like Showbiz Sandbox. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It sounds like kind of a big deal, but apparently I'm going to be told that it's not. I thought, wow, that sounds pretty convenient, because I have sometimes seen really big stories, and getting them onto a Kindle is not really practical without this sort of link. And when it is, something like that Time story, that'd be perfect for me to put on my Kindle. So I had to say, I found it really interesting. I sometimes give articles to my roommate, and it's like, you know, longer articles I think are really interesting, from The New Yorker and London Review of Books and Rolling Stone. If he could just click on the thing and get them to his Kindle in a heartbeat instead of ripping out pages from the magazine, that'd be pretty convenient.
That would be convenient. And
it was back in
2008 when I started signing up for services like Read It Later, or at the time, I guess that's changed to Pocket now. So it's an app that you can have on your iPhone or your iPad or your computer. And it allows you to save entire web pages. And I have like 3,000 or 4,000 articles in there that I will at some point read, I believe, in retirement when none of it matters anymore.
Is it something that they just save the web page and you have to have a link?
No, only in certain cases. In certain cases, yes, because they can't scrape the content off. But most of the time, it's the entire article.
Did they have like newspapers and magazines, or was it more tech stuff?
It's basically you put a little widget or extension to your browser, whether it's Chrome or Firefox or Safari, and you just, you know, say Send to Pocket or Read It Later or Instapaper, and it will scoop the page you're on. It'll scrape it off and save it for later.
So like all good multinationals, they saw a good idea and they stole it.
That's pretty much. You know, actually in business school, you know what we call that? Creative swiping. It's not theft. We'll be talking about creative swiping later during Inside Baseball. In any case, Amazon is also planning to take on major labels. And guess what, Michael? Streaming music subscription service, which is an alliteration. Streaming music subscription service, except for that music part. That was like 3 S's in a row.
Yes, I don't know if it's alliteration, because that would mean... I guess. Is it?
I don't know. It was difficult to say, difficult for me to say. But, Greg Sandoval over at The Verge is saying, Amazon is now going to take on Spotify. Oh, brother.
But we knew that, right?
No, we knew that Google was going to try and take them on, or Apple was trying to create like a radio streaming service like Pandora, and Google was more going to be more like Spotify, and then there are a whole bunch of others, like this one that it's called the Daisy Project.
Well, last week we said Apple and Amazon were pushing into subscription music services.
Oh, okay, so maybe I
think the big news here is that it's good news for the record industry, because they need a lot of people competing and offering services, because the more people there are, the less likely you'll have one company dominate and suddenly have the record labels over a barrel.
Yeah, well, they're also getting into TV series. Amazon, that is. They just greenlit a TV series version of Zombieland, so they're taking on Netflix. You know, everybody is their competitor, frankly.
That's right. Zombieland, that's the movie starring Woody Harrelson.
That's right.
And
Jesse Eisenberg.
Jesse Eisenberg, who I just saw on stage in his own play. That sounds like a really bad idea. No, it's not that there can't be more than one zombie TV show. There used to be a dozen Westerns or a dozen cop shows, a dozen medical dramas. But somehow, Zombieland, it just sounds like a desperate attempt to catch up with The Walking Dead. And I like the movie, but I just feel like you're just going to be you know, rehashing something that's already being done really, really well.
Well, you know, in a line paraphrased from Jesse Eisenberg's hit movie, The Social Network, you know what's better than one zombie show on television?
What?
Two zombie shows on television.
Okay.
Okay, well, the Academy in LA has announced the dates for the next two Academy Awards. In 2014, the Oscars will take place on March 2nd, avoiding the pileup of sporting events in February. In 2015, and by the way, those sporting events, a little tiny event called the Olympics. That's what we're talking about there.
Right.
In 2015, they moved back into February, with the Oscars taking place on February 22nd. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
This changes everything. No, it's a big whoop.
Okay. Well, what about Justin Timberlake? We have to go to press before the figures are out, but it's clear Justin Timberlake is going to enjoy worldwide domination. And he says that with the little pinky in the corner of his mouth. Oh, no, that's Dr. Evil. His new album is number one in the UK, following up on his single Mirrors being number one in that country for 3 weeks. Now the album is out in the US, and early reports say it will top, not, I almost said drop, like, you know, it when his album dropped.
Mm-hmm.
No? Okay. It's a music industry reference.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, it sold 900,000 copies. That's a lot of copies.
Well, it's selling 900,000 copies. That's an estimate.
Okay.
So we'll have to see when it's done. But yeah, it's selling a lot of copies. It's a big deal. You know, music, obviously, it's a turnaround. It's coming back. We're still seeing a lot lower album sales than we've seen before. There are a lot of new revenue streams, but you need big hit albums in order to generate that, or a lot of doubles, a lot of platinum and tube double platinum. But a big hit is always good to see, and this looks like a big hit. He's going to tour around it, so everybody's happy.
Wow. And you know who's going to be really happy? Our listeners, because that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this weekend.
Almost. You know who's dominating Broadway? Because it's so late on Monday when we recorded, I actually know how the Broadway box office is doing. Justin Timberlake is dominating music. Tom Hanks is doing great on Broadway. He's in the Million Dollar Club. His show, Lucky Guy, it's practically as hot a ticket as the Book of Mormon, and it's in the... sold $1.2 million worth of tickets last week, standing room only. It's a big, big hit show long before the reviews come out. Everybody wants to see the show. So Broadway's very happy. Even though he's only there for a short run, the other good news is Cinderella, also in the Million Dollar Club, and Motown the Musical, without any names and without any buzz whatsoever, just the name of Motown, that show is in the Million Dollar Club right from the opening day of ticket sales. So Broadway has a couple of shows, along with Kinky Boots with Cyndi Lauper and others, that look like they're going to be breathing a lot of new life into Broadway. And so, that is the end of Big Deal, Big Whoop.
Well, yeah, and I'm just glad that all of these shows are taking a page out of Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. You know, they're really, they've learned a lot from that production and how to make money.
That's right. It's still on Broadway after 2 years, $1.1 million last week. Not making a lot of money compared to how much it costs, but still... almost no, you know, you're there for 2 years, you're in the top 100, you know, longest running shows in Broadway history.
So Bono and The Edge and Julie Taymor, they might be laughing all the way to the bank.
Exactly.
Well, now that moves us along to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, this story will affect people all over the world, literally, because last week we mentioned this earlier or on a previous episode, this court case that went to the Supreme Court from the Thai student Supop Kurtsang. He was buying books in his native Thailand. Then he went to Harvard and would sell them there. And this wasn't just one or two books. He was making a lot of money doing this. And the Supreme Court ruled last week in a 6-3 ruling that the first sale doctrine does not have geographic boundaries. Now, I don't know if you've noticed this, Michael, but I cannot speak this week.
That's a problem for a podcast.
That's true. But apparently, books sold overseas can now be resold legally in the U.S. just as...
they always could.
They always could. That's true. Just as, you know, the books that are purchased here can be resold here or overseas. It's the first sale doctrine. On the losing end of this ruling was... and this ruling was written by Justice Stephen Breyer. On the losing
Please don't retire. Please don't retire.
Yeah, well, that's no comment. Major entertainment companies on the losing end, and trade groups like the MPAA and the RIAA. On the winning end, consumers who actually own books and movies and CDs, they purchase overseas. Big deal or big whoop, Michael? What do you think? I know we're not big deal or big whoop, but I still wanted to get your feedback on this.
Well, it's a very big deal. It says, basically, if you buy a book, you own it. The practical effect, if they had said, no, you don't have the right to buy a book overseas and come back to the U.S. and then sell it, would have been catastrophic. I mean, the ramifications would have been bizarre. I go to England and I buy something. I come back here and like, oh, you can't sell that. Like, what are you talking about? It would have just been incredibly confusing for a lot of businesses, not just used bookstores, but eBay and, you know, ownership of material in general would have been very confused. So they don't like it. The, you know, the record labels and the book publishers and the movie studios, they hate it because they say, well, we have to be able to price things differently in different markets. So they want to be able to have one price in Thailand, another price in England, and another price in America. And now they're saying, no, that doesn't work. Now, you look at the drug companies.
I was just going to go there. I was going to say, I wonder what that does to pharmaceuticals where in Africa, they sell it for their drugs, right, which are still under patent.
The U.S. subsidizes worldwide drug sales because we pay a premium for drugs,
right,
and the pharmaceutical companies sell them cheaper overseas. Now, of course, our government has its hands tied. They're not even allowed to ask for, you know, generic versions of drugs. But with all the healthcare changes coming along, somebody at some point is going to say, hey, let's buy our drugs in Canada because now it's legal.
Right, but there's, you know, a whole other body
of legislative work. Yes,
yeah,
yes.
The FDA, the Federal Food and Drug Administration, would say, "Oh, you can't do that. You can't just import that kind of stuff. That's, you know, like importing animals and plants. You can't just bring that stuff into the country."
But here's why it really matters. It's another example that when you buy something, you own it. It doesn't matter where you buy it. You bought it, you own it. Now this is going to affect us when it gets to digital rights, because when I buy an album in digital format or a book as an ebook or a movie as a digital download, the studios tell me, oh, you don't own that. You're just borrowing it and we can take it back whenever we want.
In all fairness, they're saying you're licensing it.
That's in all fairness. It's the same damn thing. They're saying they can take it back whenever they want.
That
I call
true.
That borrowing. Licensing sounds confusing. They let me borrow it and they can take it back whenever they want. And that's malarkey. And this is one more ruling that's going to strengthen the case when that case does go to the courts to say, you know what, just because I bought something digitally doesn't mean I've given up all my first sale rights. And that's going to be an important ruling. I bet they quote it down the road in that case. And I should say, actually, Stephen Breyer should retire because we want to have two new Supreme Court justices picked before this next president is elected. And therefore, he's about to retire. So maybe now's the time to go. You did a great job.
Now get out. The door opens outward.
But now this is great. Now, I didn't know this. I'm a big science fiction fan, but you pulled out a quote from nowhere that I've never heard about that relates to this ruling.
That's right. I mean, an excerpt from the ruling read, Wiley and the dissent claim that a non-geographical interpretation will make it difficult, perhaps impossible, for publishers and other copyright holders to divide foreign and domestic markets.
And they say, so what?
Yeah, we concede that is so. A publisher may find it more difficult to charge different prices for the same book in different geographic markets, but we do not see how these facts help Wiley, for we can find no basic principle of copyright law that suggests that publishers are especially entitled to such rights. So that's the excerpt that Stephen Breyer wrote in his ruling.
Right. He says, sorry that it makes your job harder, but we don't really care.
Yeah, we're not your slaves here to, you know, we're not your
security
guards.
The Supreme Court is not here to make your business commercial interests easier.
Right. Now, it reminded me of a quote that's often used when talking about intellectual property law from Robert Heinlein, who was a science fiction author. And in 1939, his first story was titled Lifeline, and it contained the following quote. And this is from 1939. Okay. This is what's remarkable about this. And it was a fiction piece. So here it goes. Here's the quote. There has grown up in the minds of certain groups in this country the notion that because a man or corporation has made a profit out of the public for a number of years, the government and the courts are charged with the duty of guaranteeing such profit in the future, even in the face of changing circumstances and contrary to public interest. This strange doctrine is not supported by statute or common law. Neither individuals nor corporations have any right to come into court and ask that the clock of history be stopped or turned back.
And of course, it applies to much more than just copyright law in business interests in general. But basically, it says, Mickey Mouse, we're looking at you.
Yes, that's really, I don't think that's what he was referring to in 1939, mind you.
Certainly not.
But you're right. I mean, as you said, trade groups are very upset with the ruling. You know, will remain to be seen what will become of, or what the ramifications will be. I did ask the MPAA, a representative from the MPAA, to join us. And Howard Gantman, who was the person I was speaking with, rightfully said, hey, look, you know, this is a publishing industry thing. This is a, you know, the Association of Publishers and Wiley. They're the ones who should be speaking. You know, we're still, well, actually, he sent this statement. He says, we believe today's Supreme Court decision will hinder American businesses. ability to compete overseas to the detriment of the long-term economic interests of the United States and particularly its creative industries. We plan to study the decision further before determining the most appropriate action for us to take. And initially I thought that was sent, just to us, but apparently that's the MPAA's official quote about this ruling.
I think the biggest effect in the publishing industry will be to end the sale of books by geographic region. We've been talking about it for a while. Basically, you're going to buy a book, you're going to buy English language rights worldwide, or French language rights worldwide, or Cantonese or Mandarin rights worldwide. It just doesn't make any sense to slice it up by territory.
That's right. I always say, look, if you're going to buy Cantonese rights, buy them for the whole world.
Absolutely. But, again, if a book becomes a hit in the U.S. and someone in Australia reads about it, to tell them they can't buy it or they have to steal it if they want to read it, that's just stupid. And I understand how you want to – the problem now is that you have different companies owning the book and therefore you're cheating, quote unquote, one company out of their profits. But if it's owned by the same company, you don't have to have that wall and keep them from buying it. Of course, you want to launch it in different territories at different times and all that sort of stuff, and you want good publicity, but a sale is a sale. So heck, if some guy in Australia reads a book review in the Dallas Morning News, why not let him buy a copy of the book?
Well, it wasn't all bad news for Hollywood last week, at least in court. Apparently, they won this. The Hollywood studios won this big verdict against ISOHunt, which is this BitTorrent site that I guess
pirate.
Okay, pirate site. At least that's what the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I don't know what it is today. My tongue is literally tied in knots. I can't speak. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judge described why ISOHunt and its founder Gary Fung are not eligible for safe harbor. He basically, or she, depending on who the judge was, said, look, you have 7.5 million unique visitors.
What's the website? What is it? It's a website where people go to download illegal copies of movies and TV shows, right?
Right. It's called ISOHunt, and it tracks and indexes all these BitTorrent trackers. So
what they said was, well, we're not hosting pirated content. We just provide links that people follow somewhere else. It's not our content, it's someone else's. And so we're not responsible.
Right, but they say, well, wait a second, you kind of are, because you take these links and you add additional backup links in case the link disappears from whoever is hosting it. You have a backup of it, so now you're hosting that link. And, oh, by the way, you're kind of inducing others to infringe copyright. So you're not only inducing it, you're kind of semi-hosting it. You are not... safe harbor does not protect you.
And so the studios won this one. And it's a good case because it is a website that is clearly involved in illegal downloading. And as opposed to a guy who buys a book in Thailand and then legally brings it to America and sells it again, he buys a legally produced copy of the book, takes it to another country, sells it there. They don't like it, but there's nothing illegal about that. So, they should have won this case and they should have lost the last case. And it worked out right.
Sometimes that's just the way it is. But speaking of working out right, I don't know. We should move on to listener email. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And this first email comes from, and I hope I'm pronouncing your surname correctly, Richard Abelow. And it's in response to an email from Jonathan Rogers, which we read on last week's episode. Michael, do you want to take it?
Okay. It says, hi, guys. First off, love the show. Thank you. I have emailed you about Amazon Kindles before, about blacklisting a device. Sperling made a mistake about the Amazon Whisper tech on Kindles. It happened. The writer who commented about the 3G on Kindles used Whispernet as the term. I'm not sure this is correct, but that is different from what Sperling was talking about. What Sperling was talking about, the syncing of position of books, is something else. That is called Whisper Sync. What the writer was talking about is the free 3G offered on some models of the Kindle e-readers, not the Fire tablets. When Michael asked if Sprint regretted it, I would guess probably not. The free 3G is only on certain models, and they tend to be more expensive. I would bet they do not sell a lot of those models. As for Whisper Sync, when it works, it is very cool. Now you can sync audiobooks to ebooks. I think that is a very neat feature. I am not a big audiobook fan, but I am starting to experiment with them a little bit. I am finding that I can add the audiobook to an ebook purchase for around $2. You too should try and get someone from Amazon on. I think that would be fascinating. Richard Abelow.
And we certainly have tried in the past to get somebody from Amazon on, and we will continue to do so. And
so WhisperNet is where you have a device like an e-reader.
Actually, WhisperNet does not exist. It's WhisperSync is what I was...
thinking of. You used the word WhisperNet. So, yes. There's 3G service that you can get. If you buy a certain Kindle, you can get free 3G, so you can access their service anywhere. But if you don't have that, like me, if you want to sync up and get it and download a new copy of a book, you need to go onto a Wi-Fi network that you can connect to. And then what you're talking about as far as Whisper Sync is where if you're reading a book on your Kindle, you put it down, you pick up your phone. If it's a smartphone and you have your Kindle app on it, you can pick up right where you left off. It'll know what paragraph you were at and show you right the page where you're at.
And that's before cool everybody writes in to tell me that WhisperNet does exist, it does. It is the way that you can, access your... It says here, Kindle displays the items you've downloaded on the home screen. If you have a Kindle content stored in your Kindle library that isn't displayed, you can... What am I reading here?
It's like a cloud service?
Yeah, when connected... Yeah, basically it's a cloud service. Okay.
Right. And so that's cool. We've cleared up WhisperNet is the cloud service. WhisperSync is how you can pick up a book on one device, read it, put it down, and then when you go to another device, if you have it synced up properly, they'll know right where you were. So if you've read 20 pages further into the book, you pick up it on another device, they'll put you right where you want to be. And I'm fascinated by his claim that he can add the audiobook to an ebook purchase for around $2. I don't see that on Amazon, and I've been pushing for bundling for a long time. I think if you buy a hardcover book, they should give you the audiobook and ebook for free.
Or at least for $2. I mean, you know, I could see, here's an extra dollar or two.
Right. And if you just buy the ebook and then you love the book and you want to upgrade to a hardcover, they shouldn't charge you a full hardcover price. They say, oh, you want to upgrade and give us more money? Great. Give us another $7 and you get the hardcover version as well. Something like that. And he says that he's doing this bundling, that he can buy an ebook and add on an audio version for just a couple bucks. I don't see that on Amazon. I might be missing it. But, you know, let us know where you're finding that bundling availability, because I'd love to check it out.
We also have an email from CJ Flynn. You might recall he was a guest on our show to talk about high frame rate at one point.
That's right.
And he writes, hi, Sperling and Michael. Don't know if you are still following this story, but here is a pretty current story. And the story he's referring to is the visual effects industry and how it's kind of,
at a crossroads.
Yes, at a crossroads, which is exactly what the story's about. He says, not really in love with the article or the problem. It has been evolving for years and follows the same course of boom and bust and investment traps as post-production suites have had for twice as long. Also, there are tens of thousands of similar styled animation jobs that aren't being discussed. Notwithstanding, I really like the teardown that Michael gave on the lies and distortions of DreamWorks Animation. Best, CJ.
Oh, thanks very much. Tried to hold their foot to the fire again this week. The most insulting thing I saw was the one company that's captured everyone's attention about the plight of special effects companies is Rhythm and Hughes. Is that how you say it?
Rhythm and Hughes, yes.
Yeah. And one studio where somebody bought them lunch the other week. That's not really helping the problem.
Well, it is because, you know, the animators need strength to continue. And since they're not being paid anymore, and that studio actually has a film with Rhythm and Hughes that they need finished, it helped the problem quite a bit.
Speaking of finished, when people are finished listening to our podcast, how can they get in touch with us?
Talk about a segue. Wow. Well, that's a good one. Again, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. You can also call us. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are given away for free, you can find us. And we do urge you to subscribe to the show and rate, review the show in those podcast aggregators. It really does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to follow us. We have a Twitter account where our handle is @showbizsandbox. We're also on Facebook. As I mentioned, you can post stories there as a suggestion for us to cover in the following week, or as a way to start a conversation with other listeners. Our username on Facebook is showbizsandbox. So it's facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, our website is showbizsandbox.com, where you can find all of that information. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace, if that still exists, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and this week you can find Michael Giltz at...
I really do love simonandgarfunkel.com.
And you know what? If you're really struggling to find that domain, or your browser is struggling to find it, type in michaelgiltz.com to find some of his work and writing. Some of my work and writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.